and it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer really standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, we're not alone.
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. I'm really excited about tonight's show. We have a professor of history, Penn State, Professor Greg Egigian. Hopefully I pronounced that close. And he has been doing some excellent work. We're going to be talking about that, basically on the history of UFOs and, you know, the whole phenomena in general. And let's see, what else? Next week, Mac Maloney, and I'll be in studio with Mac Maloney once again. Some people didn't really care that much for it because it was kind of a four or five people and we're all kind of chatting and having, I was having a lot of fun. But I guarantee you we are going to talk about the UFO topic. So that's next week. We'll be in studio in Exeter, New Hampshire, with Mac Maloney and team. And also, he's going to give away, I think he said seven. His publisher is giving away seven books. So we're going to have call-ins, and people can win a free book that way, just in time for Christmas. And let's see. I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. I really do appreciate that. We absolutely could not do it without you. The show is expensive, and you help by supporting the show for $2 or more a month. All that information is on podcastufo.com. And we are live on KGRA Radio, and you can also see it over on our website. And it's also on our guest's website tonight as well. I saw that. And on YouTube and podcastufo.com. Then on Thursdays, we're over at the Dark Matter Digital Network. Thursday nights, I think it's 7 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, but I'm not really sure about that. It's changed a little bit over there. So anyway, all good. We are ready to roll. And Alejandro, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much. I'm excited for your show. This is going to be a good one. Your guest and I got to say hi for a second there, Greg, but I didn't get to say more about how I really am excited that you're doing this interview. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, yeah. I was telling him earlier that you and I actually, his name came up during one of the news things that we were discussing, and that's kind of where this led. So it's really really going to be fascinating to hear his side. And you two actually met when I got snowed out of Phoenix. He made it out there from Pennsylvania, and you two met briefly at one of your, I think it was 2016 or something like that.
I know. It's a missed opportunity on my part, mostly because I get so swamped and crazy. And it's funny because, you know, I'll get to meet some really cool people and they'll introduce themselves and I'll make a mental note, which is doesn't work very well because my mental notes don't last very long. And they just kind of disappear into the ether by the time my head hits the pillow. Yeah. And I'm up and running the next day. So the amount of information that I learn and forget at those conferences is pretty large. So
someone told
this is
me
one that slipped through my mental fingers.
Yeah, someone said to me one time, a short pencil is better than a long memory.
That is a great saying. I love that saying.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I'm also guilty of the same. You know, you meet a lot of people, and it's always fun out there in Phoenix getting to meet all those great people and hanging out with them.
Well, we're getting old, buddy.
I know.
Getting old. Yeah. Look at all this white hair.
I know. By the day, it's whiter. So what's going on in the UFO world?
I have a few exciting UFO stories for you, so I'll try to get through these as quickly as possible. The first couple aren't as exciting. People, I think, get kind of bored of us debunking UFO sightings. But that's not why I talk about these sightings. The reason why I talk about them is because they're in the news. You'll probably see them. And before you're at the water cooler talking to your buddies about it, you hopefully will then get my information, be able to say, or even better, you know, one of your buddies knows you're into UFOs and they come walking up and they say, hey, I saw a UFO on the news. And if you're like, well, actually, you'll seem really smart. So it's about education, right?
Yeah.
So right. I don't think we talked about this one before, but in Texas, there's been a little bit of ado made about this picture. So this lady went outside to take a picture of the sunset, and actually she got a little bit of video too. Mm-hmm. And you see what looks like a almost like a glowing saucer there. Yeah. But it actually, given my experience, and I actually did talk to Mark D'Antonio. I think we even mentioned this maybe last week. No, that was something else, actually. But it looks like a part of a contrail and or just a cloud. Of course, a contrail left by an airplane essentially is creating a cloud. And especially at sunset, you know, that's what makes sunsets so beautiful. They light up the clouds because of the angle of the sun. This piece of what appears to be either part of a contrail or just a cloud sitting there is getting lit up very brightly, so it looks fantastic. And even in the short clip, it doesn't move at all, and which would also indicate a cloud. So contrails, clouds, those are things to watch out for when you're looking at this sort of thing. The next stories aren't...
Yeah, no. Before we move on from that, it just reminds me, a few weeks ago I was driving along, and again it was like late in the afternoon, and there was patches of clouds, and one looked so tempting for me to take a picture. I just wanted to see what it would look like, but of course I was driving, but I wanted to see if it would look like a UFO, because it definitely looked like something like that up in the sky. There was a bunch of little short clouds, and with the sun hitting them, I was thinking the same thing, and I saw that image you're talking about, and it does look like a disc at first, but you probably nailed it. That's probably what it is.
Yeah, and you know, we see this a lot, because a lot of times the reporters or the people taking the accounts are not necessarily pros at looking at all this stuff. Like they don't look at it on a regular basis like we do, so they're not able to identify it. They think it looks pretty neat, and they know that if they put it out there, people are also going to get really excited about it. And sure enough, that's what's happened here, that a lot of people have gotten excited about this lady who caught a UFO during the sunset. But just so you're aware, and of course, it's always good for us to speak to these, because these are the questions we get. Hey, what about that thing in Texas? What about this here or there?
Yeah.
More Tom DeLonge news, and this actually doesn't have to do with To the Stars, his organization that's investigating UFOs. This has to do with his own personal research. So some of you may know that Tom DeLonge has been doing his own research for a long time, and he's developed, you know, kind of his ideas into a few different scripts and stories out there. Some of them are graphic novels. And in particular, he has a graphic novel, which is essentially a name for a comic book, another more sophisticated name for a comic book. He's got one called Strange Times. And he says it was even inspired by his website, Strange Times, which, of course, was done years ago. And you may not know this, but he would post openminds.tv stories there often with our permission, because, you know, we loved working with him way back then. That's when we developed our relationship. But he developed this graphic comic, which is kind of about these skateboard kids who find all of this weird stuff about UFOs and everything. And TBS has picked it up, so it's going to be a television series.
Really?
There was a rumor out there that it was going to be a cartoon, kind of an adult cartoon, but I think that might have been an assumption, because this is based off of a graphic novel. Other stories out there make it look like it'll be live action, so actual actors and everything out there. So I'm not quite sure if it's going to be live action or not, but definitely a series is going to be made based off of Tom DeLonge's Strange Times, which is kind of his idea, you know, this piece that he used for his idea of what's going on with UFOs and everything. So this ought to be interesting, and obviously he's extremely excited about it. So that's pretty interesting, huh?
Yeah, that's really a turn of careers, isn't it, if you think about it?
Right, I know. But that's what he's wanted, you know. And the good thing about this is at least it's an outlet for him to get out his ideas, because some of you may notice he has not really been – he was very vocal, especially early last year essentially early last year. We're still in 2018. But then once this New York Times article came out, and once he started this To the Stars Academy to do serious research, he's really taken a back seat, at least when it comes to – vocalizing or sharing his opinions on this topic. Instead, he's been kind of allowing his researchers and work. We've heard more from Luis Elizondo than anybody really in the last year because they're doing very careful work. So he's making sure he's not tainting the waters there. So I'm sure he appreciates finally having this outlet for his ideas about the topic.
You know, you don't, you know, there's a lot of people that kind of bash, you know, Tom DeLonge. But one thing I got to tell you, you don't see him trying to grab any of the glory that the December 16th article, you know, had in the New York Times, really. You know, I mean, there's mentioning, of course, Lou Elizondo's, you know, featured in that. But there's not really a lot going on when it's, in fact, it was his efforts that actually, you know, made these things come forward, really.
Exactly. It was his efforts completely. That's why I've, you know, most of my articles have been from that angle is here's this organization, but, you know, it's this rock star who made this all happen. And it really was his efforts. If he wouldn't have had this platform, this To the Stars Academy, then Elizondo, for Elizondo to join and then have this outlet to be able to share, we might still not know about this secret Pentagon, you know, UFO project. That is ongoing. And I mean, there's new information to be discovered about this project on a regular basis. And I could share with you, even recently, I talked with George Knapp, and he is, you know, still looking into this, and he's prepared to release more information, too. So this is the, you know, the fruit that keeps on giving, and we're going to get more and more information as time goes on. So stay tuned, because it's very exciting times with all of this. And this is kind of exciting, too, because I think this next story I'm going to get to kind of has allowed to happen because of these new revelations that Tom DeLonge helped inspire. And that is, you've probably seen in the news a lot about this NASA scientist who's saying we need to look into aliens. This all started with a Fox News story. And actually, he's come out to say, well, Fox News didn't get it right, and they didn't actually interview him before they released the story, but they did watch a lecture and a paper that he did for SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, where he was arguing essentially that aliens could have visited here, we don't know, and that we need to take UFO stories seriously and do some serious research to figure out if that's the case. He feels that the Fox story that came out kind of gave the impression that he believes definitively that, you know, aliens have been here, and it's something we need to prove, and that's why people need to pay attention. He's correcting to say that, no, what I'm saying is it's entirely possible. And because of that reason, that's why we need to take this information seriously, because there could be discoveries made by information and evidence and physical evidence that we have right here on the planet, which I think makes complete sense. And it's one of the frustrating things that when it comes to SETI, of course, you have debated Shostak, the lead scientist for SETI, on your show. But, they, you know, Shostak does an excellent job. And I do a lecture, Astronomers and UFOs, and it's funny, I start with talking about how great Shostak is, but him being a bonehead is what inspired me to do this lecture because of a couple of things. He says if UFOs were here, astronomers would see them, and it's kind of a silly thing because astronomers have seen UFOs, so that's the nature of that lecture. But he argues so strongly and so convincingly that the universe must be, you know, teeming with life, yet they can't get here. And that's the frustrating part, is that if there are if the likelihood of extraterrestrial civilizations, intelligent ones, is so high and the odds are so high that they're out there, then it would lend to – it would seem intuitively obvious that the possibility that we've been visited in the past or even potentially being visited now, it is a possibility. Perhaps we don't have strong evidence to say that that is certainly happening. But it's – you know, their argument lends to the and sets the base, a very strong one, for the argument that it's a possibility. And that's what this scientist is out there trying to say. Because it's possible, we need to take the possibility seriously, and we need to investigate any potential evidence showing that this has occurred or is occurring.
You know, the guest I have, I'm going to talk to him about SETI, because I've heard him talk about that subject. And one of the things he says is, you know, they basically have as much evidence as we do to get their funding, you know, which I think
is a great point.
Yeah.
And over the years, you know, they have not had much in the way of fruits for their efforts.
That's right.
I think that they would admit that we don't have any evidence over all of these years. Same could be said of UFO research, although some people have argued that in the UFO research arena, there's been more that has been gained. And I think if you look at the Pentagon program and the evidence that Luis Elizondo has put forth, which is only a fraction of the information that they gathered, because as he says, he hasn't been given the liberty to share any more information. You know, there's definitely a strong case to be made that at least there are mysterious occurrences that have happened that could potentially, kind of like the other scientist, Columbano is his name, by the way, proposed, that there's enough there to look at to begin to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, there's supposedly thousands of trace cases, you know, where there was some type of trace evidence.
I don't personally, there's potential trace cases, but the French, this is kind of the JPON, the French UFO organization that is under their space program. Those are their most important cases. It's their handful of cases where they do feel that there have been physical trace evidence, and they do have cases where they feel, you know, plants, for example, have been affected by electromagnetic effects that prove to them that there has been at least some physical contact of some sort. And when that sort of evidence piles up, it's something to look at.
Right. Alejandro, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. And I'll talk to you next week. Actually, I won't talk
to
you next week.
All right, talk to you later.
Next week I'll be in studio, so sorry it's not going to be next week, so it'll be, I know, it's going to be after Christmas. So.
All right.
On YouTube you can see the sad face. All right, Alejandro, you take care. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. You too. Have a great show.
All right. Thank you. So our guest tonight, I'm real excited, is Professor Greg Aghigian. He's a professor of history at Penn State University, where he specializes in history of science and medicine. He's written and taught extensively about the topics as the history of disability, the history of crime and prisons, and the history of madness. And I actually saw some of his lectures online on that. Very interesting. Most recently, he's embarked on writing the history of UFO and alien contact phenomenon with an eye toward understanding its rise and development worldwide. He's received funding for his research from the American Philosophical Society, the American Historical Association, NASA, and the Smithsonian Institute. Wow. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Great. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Excellent. So I guess I'm going to have to ask right off the bat, why UFOs? Professor of History, how did you fall into UFOs? Or how did they fall into you?
Yeah, they fell. Well, you know, there's the sort of more long range sort of answer and the short range answer. The kind of long range answer is that I, like so many people, particularly of my generation, as you can tell, I've got my share of gray hair. I grew up and was utterly, utterly fascinated with UFOs and aliens. And the literature. And so I, as a kid, I couldn't get enough of this stuff. And so I would read everything I could read about. I would watch any TV specials. I remember really vividly that series back in, I guess that was the 70s, right? In Search of, with Leonard Nimoy, right?
Yeah.
And I would read about this stuff, was utterly fascinated with it. But I also got really interested too in reading like the debunkers too. You know, I was fascinated with hearing from Philip Kloss. I loved Carl Sagan. I still remember vividly going to my father taking me to see a Carl Sagan lecture. He was visiting.
Oh, wow.
I grew up in upstate New York, and he was visiting, and that was just utterly. So I was fascinated with it. And it was, for me, it was, you know, I think about it in retrospect. I tell people in many, many ways, my interest in the study and the reading about UFOs and UFO literature, I think, was the beginning of my becoming a professor of history.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was my introduction to thinking about big questions, investigating things, uncovering, you know, lifting up rocks and uncovering stories, trying to be critical, but trying to be open, all these kinds of things. I in a sense, I realized I kind of was learning by my experience doing that. And so that's where I first became interested in it. But I have to say, then I kind of moved on to other things. And as you can tell, I started to study and research other kinds of fields. But I've always been interested in the history of science and medicine. And then what happened was, a few years ago, I was on a panel at a conference on a completely different subject with a colleague of mine. And she was working on a book project that was going to involve a bunch of people writing about the occult. Mm-hmm. And the occult, particularly in and after Nazi Germany, in Germany. And it was some fascinating stuff. And I said to her offhand, I said, you know, I always wondered, did that whole UFO thing, like, ever take place in Germany? You know, was that ever a big thing there? She's like, I have no idea, but if you ever wanted to write on it, we would love to publish whatever you're writing. I'm like, well, I don't have time for that. Well, it kind of stuck in my craw. I just had this thing, and it's an itch I had to scratch. And so I started doing some, you know, research on my own with a database that I had at the university library, and started looking into the early kinds of experiences of people reporting UFOs in Germany in the 40s and 50s. And I found all this stuff, and I was fascinated with it. I ended up writing something up about it. Didn't actually ever get published in that book, because in the end it was not related enough. But I followed that, and then, you know, as I was ready to take on a new project, a friend of mine said, hey, why don't you do this? Why don't you jump into there? Because you find this stuff fascinating. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. There must be so much that's been written on it. And that's when I kind of discovered that, guess what? Academic historians, you know, people of my tribe, have shown almost no interest in the subject whatsoever.
Right.
I mean, we have David Jacobs' book in, what, 1975. Michael Swords is a PhD in history, and he's written on stuff, though I don't know that he's ever really, Mike, I don't think he's ever written a whole book on the history of the phenomenon. So that was it. And I thought, that's really strange. And so I thought, yeah, this sounds like something that's worthy, it's interesting to me, and it's a chance to go back and look over things that really had a real big impact on me during many formative years in my life. And now I can go back and look over this stuff. I've got this sort of the eye and the ears of a historian to sort of be my guide as I go through all this.
Why would you think that there is such a trepidation, and actually someone with your background, you know, just shying away from the topic? Is it the old ridicule factor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I mean, I think that is there, and that has been there. Okay, there's no question about it that people, historians are an interesting group of people. We're an interesting group of people, but there is a level in which they have sometimes played things pretty, you know, hold their cards close to the vest and don't sort of venture out into some topics and areas. It can take some time for those things to take place. But that said, the funny thing to me is that, you know, historians are kind of unique in not going into this. If you look since, say, the late 1960s at other kind of academic groups, the UFO phenomenon has been studied by everything from, you know, meteorologists, anthropologists, scholars of religious studies, folklorists, psychologists, a whole bunch of people. So we are kind of odd in that we've kind of steered clear of this thing. And it's a bit of it still is kind of a bit of a mystery to me, because there's no trace of anybody ever sort of publicly coming out and saying, hey, nobody should study this stuff or nobody should look into this stuff. It's more of a kind of thing that's gone around unstated. And that's why, in a sense, the question has to be, why have, you know, historians of all people been so nervous about going into something when, you know, we've long since gone into all sorts of topics that seem to be controversial or maybe make people nervous when they sort of discuss it. So to me, it's always been a little odd in that regard. There are people now who are doing it more, and now it's a topic where actually there's a whole group of young people in PhD programs in both here in the U.S. and in Canada who are starting to take this up as a historical project. But it's taken this long. It's taken this long.
Okay, we'll jump back to that. We're actually at break time right now. So, all right, everyone. So we're going to take a little break here. And my guest tonight is Professor Greg. And we'll be right back. All right. Yeah, we'll pick that back up after the break because I think that's fascinating. I do want to talk about that. So have you, during the break here, I don't really see any questions up there right now, but have you had ridicule from colleagues at all about this interest?
I cannot say I've ever gotten anything along those lines. I've never gotten that. There are times I feel like I get maybe a raised eyebrow from somebody. More often than not, the most I've received, I think, are I can think of some instances where I think I had some people who I think thought this all was rather frivolous. You know, why aren't you studying the things that really matter? Right. You should be studying, you know, kings and queens and wars and politics and things like that. And I always tell people I've done a lot of that. And it's not to say that this stuff doesn't actually, you know, have consequences and is meaningful. And part of what I argue with those people is that, in fact, the story of the flying saucer phenomenon and claims of alien contact and all of that that takes place after World War II has been a very momentous event in human history. And it's had real impacts on all sorts of things, ranging from politics to the ways in which we think about scientific expertise. So for me, I would make the sort of counter argument to those people that, no, I think this stuff is as equally interesting and important as that stuff. But on the whole, the reactions and responses I have gotten from most of my colleagues is excitement. They all find it pretty cool.
Wow. Well, and actually, if we could figure out what those things are, who's driving the craft, so to speak, I think that would be one of the biggest answers. You know, very, very, very important answer. You know, of course, I don't expect to actually know about that anytime soon. You know, along those lines, I heard someone from the I think it was the late 40s or early 50s. It was a black and white film. And he was an older gentleman. And he was saying, I just hope I get to know in my lifetime, you know, what the UFO, if it's aliens or not, or something. He said something like that.
It's true. It's true. I mean, I recently I was doing some stuff writing, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it. But, you know, we are at the 50th anniversary of the issuing of the final report of the Condon Committee back in 1969. And I was writing something up about all that and was looking at those very early weeks and months as the Condon Committee started its work in 1966. And if you look at the coverage, what people were saying was that kind of thing. There was huge expectations, real excitement about, my God, we're finally going to have the answers. We're finally going to have people look into this. And so that to me was fascinating, was to see that people from all sort of walks of life saw that as a great opportunity.
Which actually was played down. There was one professor that was at Colorado, University of Colorado or something like that, right? All right, welcome back. My guest tonight is Professor Greg. I'm going to say it wrong. Egigorian. Can you say your name for us, please?
Egigian.
Egigian. Okay.
Greg Egigian.
Egigian. Got it. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry about that.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Seeing the name spelled out scares me.
So it's going to be Greg.
Okay, Greg. Professor Greg. Right before we went to break, you were talking about there are some actually younger people looking into the topic. And did you say that there are the PhDs? No one's. I know that there's been some thesis. I've talked to Stan Friedman, told me there was a few students that have run their thesis on something to do with UFOs. Is this what's going on, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, what I see is a lot of, I'll tell you what a lot of the younger people who are working on this topic are really interested in, is a lot of them I know are working on looking at how the government and militaries responded to this stuff. Particularly, they're looking in the 1950s and 60s. A lot of their research is they're interested in this. They're interested in trying to figure out how this stuff sort of set in motion investigative bodies and agencies, UFO desks, as they're called in a place like the UK, right? How they responded, the extent to which they took this stuff seriously or didn't take it seriously, and then also how they tried to play this all out vis-a-vis the media, right, and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of what their work, a lot of them I know, are working on.
Wow, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny when you go to, like, you were out at Phoenix, you went to the conference out there, and you don't see a lot of young people actually attending. You know, maybe it's something mm-hmm. they look more or less online, and that's as far as it gets. I'm not sure. But they're not, like, gathering it. I mean, there are a few. I'm not saying there aren't any, but there's just a few compared to, you know, a lot of people with the same type of hair you and I have. Gray hair.
So. No, I think you're right. What you're saying is confirmed by other people elsewhere. You know, I do because this project involves looking at sort of developments outside the United States. I talk to a lot of connections with a lot of UFO researchers in Europe, for instance. And I hear this from people in Sweden. I hear this from people in Italy. I hear this from researchers in Great Britain, that they all are having that experience. That as one guy said to me in Sweden, it is really hard to get young people involved like we once did. They all go to the internet. They all sort of, that tends to be the place that attracts them. And while that means they may still be very interested in this stuff, but what it means is they don't tend to be part of organizations. They don't tend to be a part of that community in the same way that things used to be, right? And so I hear this from a lot of the veterans, right, who sort of lament that kind of change happening.
Yeah, the only thing I've talked to a lot of people, because I'm also in the fine arts and antiques, I'm an appraiser, and I've talked to a lot of people saying that young people are just not interested. They're not going to any events like you know, the shows, the antique shows and things like that. But but what I have seen a great surge in is Comic-Cons. There's tons of young people at Comic-Cons, you know, and that's somehow it's the pop culture hook, you know, that gets them involved. And I can't remember who it was. It might have even been Alejandro that actually went to a Comic-Con and set up a booth about UFOs and was successful. So... Yeah.
I would think that would do it. And I think probably the gaming community too, right?
Because
is huge, huge.
Yeah.
So those are two areas where I could see connections and sort of these. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think is some other reasons why this subject is neglected when it comes to, you know, academics?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things is the sense that there is, how shall I put it, no sort of sense or guidance you get from the mainstream of academic communities who would naturally gravitate towards this topic. That is to say, people like astronomers, people like astrophysicists, chemists, whatever it might be. No major organization, no sort of large number of people in the field who have sort of stood up and said, this demands all sorts of investigation, investigations that are going to involve federal funding or funding from sort of the typical kind of sources you get, who then are going to, after they get this funding, then present their research in peer-reviewed journals. In other words, follow the basic principles of academic research that all of us end up doing who are in this line of work, right? Nobody really has done that and is doing that. The Condon Committee that was formed in the 1960s, right, and that issued its final report 50 years ago, was actually tasked with assessing that very question. I mean, if you look at the original sort of task for that committee, Condon himself says we were tasked not to decide whether this was of importance, national security importance. He said, because the military's already said that's not important. He said, what we were tasked to do is to decide whether the government should think about investing money in investigating this stuff. And the conclusion we came to was no. And in a sense, that became sort of the moment in which it was kind of a definitive answer on the question, at least viewed from the perspective of many. And so that meant, therefore, all the kinds of research that gets done the way it gets done now, which is, right, privately. Gets done by, you know, folks who are associated with To the Stars, right? Or it gets done by just a lot of average, you know, folks who are just interested on their own, who do all the legwork on their own.
Right, right.
So I think that creates it, yeah.
Pardon me. Brian in the chat room has written this question here. Considering the strong evidence for government disinformation and cover-up, is witness testimony the only historical access point to the UFO topic? How does that affect your research?
Yeah, that's a good question. So you do have the witness testimony, but there's actually quite a lot. I mean, one of the things I had not expected when I got into this was to realize not just how much material is out there and available. Anybody who goes and investigates UFOs, right, knows that there's a lot of stuff, especially in the age of the internet. But one of the things I found was that ufologists, people who have, dating back to the very earliest ones back in the 1950s, are amazing archivists. They almost all of them kept all these files and records of their research. And naturally they were doing it, right? Because they were trying to connect dots, right? They were trying to see if there's a pattern to these things. And so most all of them would keep these not only large amounts of information that they were tracking, right? Either they were getting it through their local organization, if they were involved in an organization and people they were interviewing, or they would keep newspaper clippings or anything along these lines, but they would also keep them very well organized. And so one of the things we have is a large number of personal papers of UFO researchers, many of whom now are long gone, right, who aren't around anymore. Gordon Creighton, for instance, in the UK, right, who was one of the big figures, right? Their papers are available in archives. So you can now go into that material and see the kind of correspondence that these people had with people who were writing them saying, hey, this is something I've seen, or here's some photographs I've taken. So we do have the kinds of things of material that Brian's talking about, you know, from say Project Blue Book or whatever, right, from these sort of military archives or the UK Defense Ministry. That material is there. But we also now have all these other materials, and they just keep growing. We have more and more of it. Some of the stuff is even online. So you can go back and look at files from the organization APRO, or files from people who worked for NICAP, right, in ways that wasn't really possible I think 20 years ago, because a lot of people who've been involved now are retiring or have passed away. And the sense for a lot of those folks is we want to leave that information for history, right? For people to go and look at. So that's a lot of what we get to look at and utilize for sort of getting a better understanding of sort of the history of the UFO phenomenon.
I'm going to be my upcoming guest soon is Dave Marler, and he has a research library in Albuquerque, and that's right outside of Albuquerque, and it's open for anyone to do research at. We're going to be talking about that, and he's very careful.
Give him my regards. We've met.
Oh, yeah. You have. Yeah. So, and also you mentioned Sweden, the Klaus Von in Sweden. They have a wonderful library there. And I saw on your website that you went to Italy. I'm pretty jealous that you got to go over there and see their library there. You want to talk a little bit about that? It was in Turin, or how do you say where it was?
It was in Turin. And Eduardo Russo invited me. I had a chance to chat with him and several other of the kind of the veterans involved in UFO. A lot of them have been active since the 1970s working. But you're quite right. The Turin Research Center and Library is really second. I mean, and this is the way at least Eduardo talked about it with me. It certainly looked that way to me. Is second only to the one in Sweden, in Norrköping, Sweden, in terms of its size, in terms of the amount of material they have. And in both places, what you see when you go to these places, first of all, is you have these amazingly friendly, kind and generous people who sort of open up the place to you, give you a sense of what's there, and then let you dig around. But what you also see is a remarkable collection of material, as I say, ranging from, you know, the personal papers of UFO researchers who want to make sure that all this stuff that they did gets preserved. But you also have the important work of collecting entire periodicals, right? UFO magazines, UFO newsletters of not just national organizations, but also local ones, the kinds of things that, frankly, tend to disappear over time, right? That stuff is absolutely invaluable for anybody who wants to do historical research and to reconstruct the way people used to go about doing things. That, to me, is really cool stuff to get hands on and to take a look at.
So well documented. And, you know, there are... just in what I do as far as appraising and things like that, I know that so many things get tossed out. Like they say that, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer for, you know, 25 years, and people have deeds up in their attic. They have no idea they're signed by Abraham Lincoln, you know, a $3,000 or $4,000 signature, you know, type of thing. A lot of things do get just plain tossed out. And I think of, for instance, Paul Benowitz's case. I don't know if you've ever heard of Paul Benowitz. In New Mexico. But anyway, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of documents in that family, and it ended very poorly for him. So no one really wants to go in and try to talk to the family about, you know, trying to get that information. But I think it's great to preserve it. And again, the show I'll be doing with Dave Marler, we'll be discussing a lot of that. So... as far as what do you consider some of the really interesting historical cases that are pretty solid and, you know, made an impression on you?
Yeah. So, you know, what I always say to folks is for me, what interests me, I get particularly sort of excited about the geeky historian here is, I get excited by certain figures or certain kinds of moments in history where I feel like there is a sort of a meeting or a kind of an intersection of a lot of different forces that often means forces that are in a collision course and they maybe provoke a kind of a brouhaha, right? About so a lot of those things are the things that sort of get my attention. I mean, I'm kind of fascinated, for instance, especially with, say, something like the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, right? Mm-hmm. Which in many ways, right, a lot of people see as sort of the first the first case. We know it wasn't the first case, but it's the one that gets all the attention, particularly in the United States. And in a sense, the case itself is intriguing. But what's really kind of striking to me about this case that sort of comes to the public attention, I think only in what, 1965, 1966, even though it was supposed to have taken place several years earlier, is that you have kind of this intriguing thing, which is that you've got the Hills and their experience. You've got them going to Donald Kehoe and people in NICAP for assistance in making sense of this, and then they sort of conduct their own investigation. You then have this famous journalist at the time, another kind of an unsung person in the history of UFOs, is John Fuller, who I heard you just talking about Exeter, right? And who yeah. wrote the incident at Exeter, right? But then he writes The Interrupted Journey, who really makes that case, is the key to making that case what it was, by writing it up in a book that is absolutely riveting, right? In a way that probably Barney and Betty could not have done. So you needed this sort of journalist figure to sort of do that. But then what's kind of intriguing to me about it is that while this becomes a best-selling book, while it gets lots and lots of attention, by and large, the interesting thing is you don't get a lot of stories of alien abduction until really in the mid to late part of the 1970s. You don't get a lot of people saying similar things. You don't get, the kind of dig on this is that what this does is it creates a model for copycats and people who are going to mimic it, right? But you don't have that. That doesn't really happen. It takes about 10 years for you to start to see the emergence of things that Travis Walton, right? The Travis Walton story that then takes place, for instance. And it shares some elements of this stuff, but it's not the same kind of a story. So I find, to me, what's kind of interesting is both the way in which that story about the scenario of alien abduction that comes with the Hills takes shape, but I'm also kind of intrigued by this sort of lag, this sort of almost 10-year period in which there's not anything else that sort of gets people's attention on the same scale for another 10 years or so. Why? How is it that happens? What is it about that case, or how it was written up, or how people sort of moved on to other topics, that meant that this case really doesn't take sort of assume the stature it does until really the 1970s and 80s? And that's when the Hills case really becomes kind of the cause celeb, right, in terms of alien abduction stories.
Right. The movie came out. Yeah. I can't remember exactly what year it was. It was in the 70s.
It was the 70s. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And so
it really doesn't sort of take on that kind of stature. And you could say the same thing about Roswell, right? Roswell wasn't a big story for right. many decades, right, until Stan Friedman sort of made it into one and rediscovered the story, right? So that's a kind of an intriguing sort of lesson in the way in which things can emerge, then disappear, and then reemerge again as sort of getting on people's radar, right?
I asked Stan last time I spoke with him if he thought that the Roswell story would have come out if he did not have that situation where, where he stumbled into the whole thing. It was actually, he was waiting at a radio station and the topic just came up to talk to, and that's kind of how that whole thing happened. And I think he said that he thinks it would have come out just eventually, and probably would have, but who knows?
Yeah.
And so what do you think of that? Do you think that whole thing has been blown way out of proportion? Or what do you think about Roswell in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Roswell case is again. So I look at things again. I look at things pretty differently. One of the things I always tell people, whether I'm talking to professor of physics and astrophysics, or talking to somebody who's had a UFO experience, or talking to somebody like Stan Friedman, I tell everybody the same thing, which is that my approach to this stuff is I just stand. I'm an outsider in a sense. Okay, I do not go about picking sides, trying to decide is this real or is this something to debunk, or is this something to promote and say people need to take this more seriously. My approach is really, for lack of a better term, more journalistic, if you will, right? And so what I'm kind of interested in when I look at a case like Roswell is the kind of PR about it, right? And particularly at the moment, the PR about it. It is a case in which clearly secrets were being kept about an event that took place in an area where the military was active, right? Now, that is not an unusual thing to happen, right? This is what the military does, and it particularly does those things in the wake of World War II. I think what we often forget is the kind of secrecy and the resistance to talking about anything related to military technology, military investigations and all, that we associate with the Cold War was a phenomenon that precedes the Cold War. It was something that was a big part of World War II. And so when things start to bleed into the Cold War in those mid-1940s, there's just a carryover that takes place. It's kind of the default setting of the military is always deny everything, right? Yeah. It's just deny everything. And so in a sense, I've often looked at that and said that kind of response to me doesn't read as conspiracy. To me, it reads as, you know, this is just what we do. We don't like to share information about the things that go on, you know, on our bases or in our encampments, right? And so to me, when it comes to these concerns that people have about why don't we get more information, can't we get more information, what I see and what I read is a kind of a situation in which the authorities in question clearly had reasons, because they were playing around with all sorts of new technologies that they didn't want the Soviet Union to have any awareness of. They are going to concoct things. They are going to change their stories if it means it creates a little more cloudies up the picture in some way. And so I think that adds a lot of fuel to the fire,
Definitely. And after the war, you know, everyone did take the government very seriously and, you know, the oath very seriously. And, you know, so there was a lot of that. So we are ready to go into break, and we'll see if we have some questions coming up. So, cool. All right. So everyone hang in there. We'll be right back right after these messages. So let's see. I'm looking to see if we had any other questions. So have you heard of John Greenwald? Someone mentioned him in the chat room. He has released a lot of Freedom of Information Act documents. Mm. You know, I'm going to say hundreds of thousands of documents. Mm. He's really, you know, you talk about he's on the younger side. And so he's doing this all digital. And so there's a lot of information because of him. And and a lot on historical cases. So there, I will tell you that after we go back, we're going to open the phone lines too. So if anyone wants to call in, we'll be taking calls a little bit later on. Let's see. I do have a question. Some histories from do you ever look into any of the histories from pertaining to the Bible and aliens? That's a question in chat.
Yeah. I mean, because I think what's intriguing is there right after, very, very soon after the whole appearance of the first flying saucers, of the Kenneth Arnold sighting in 47, within the span of just a few years, you do get people who start to say that that UFOs are of direct relevance to religion and to the Bible, right? And you get it on two counts. One are theologians, actually. It's actually real, honest-to-God theologians in both Protestant and Catholic churches who are asking questions and say, if these are aliens, this raises all sorts of theological questions, right? Are these people saved? Who are they? Are they the equivalent of fallen angels, or are they perhaps beings who are actually living in paradise and who are now visiting us? I mean, there's actual in the early 1950s real serious discussions about this among theologians.
Wow.
But then what you also get are people, and there's a very famous Russian figure by the name of Agrest who does the research on this, who basically starts to say, I think we need to look at documents like the Bible and like archaeological evidence and look for any indications that these might be alien in nature and origins, right? So that kind of line of questioning, that kind of thing, opens up actually already in the early 1950s, I think, is when Agrest starts to do this stuff, way before Eric von Däniken and people like that. He's doing this decades beforehand. And so it does lead to people to start to, and if you look at a lot of UFO periodicals in the 50s, there's already a lot of people who are very, very interested in drawing those connections and seeing, are there ways to see evidence in the Bible that might reflect back on what's happening to us today, and vice versa? Might UFOs give us a way to revisit some of those passages in the Bible? So there's a story to be told about those connections and the way that gets sort of minted in the early 50s and 60s.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming back in about 20 seconds, but someone did have a question about your thoughts on ancient aliens, but I don't think we're going to have time to cover that in this break, so we will carry that into the show itself. Right, that sounds good. So we will, again, we'll be taking calls right after we go back live. And sometimes people call in, sometimes they don't. We'll see what happens. All right, welcome back. My guest is Professor Greg. How do you like that?
I like that.
Yeah. So we're having a good time. We're talking about the history of UFOs. And earlier on, with Alejandro, I was talking about SETI. I heard your take on SETI, and I wanted to discuss that a little bit, what you thought in general. And I believe I heard you say you think there's some type of parallel between ufology and SETI. And so I'd like for you to discuss that, if you would.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, so, you know, SETI is born basically right around the turn of the 1960s. So right around, 59, 60, 61, that group that forms, that becomes this, you know, Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, among others, who are involved in that. If you look at SETI and the way SETI plays out, it's really intriguing, particularly when you think about it historically, for a couple of reasons. One is, similar to ufology, researchers who have this idea that maybe what we do is we can try to detect signals that are being sent to us, or might possibly be being sent in our direction. They're walking a tightrope, because a lot of people in their community are thinking, this is kind of crazy. This doesn't seem to be normal kind of science to us. And so they're kind of having to walk this kind of tightrope. And that's something similar to what you see in ufology, is this question is, you know, sometimes, hey, is this line of investigation really warranted? Is this maybe a bit on the margins, that kind of thing? But what you also get, to my mind, is the interesting thing about SETI is that for all of the work that's been done and all of the thinking about it, SETI basically has been, as a scientific venture, been not terribly well-funded relative to other kind of big scientific projects, similar to ufology, which has always been under-financed and underfunded, and that it has basically not, of course, had any real positives to show for it, right? It hasn't had any major findings. And in fact, this has, if you look at the history of SETI, when it's basically went before the government to try to get funding. This has been one of the hurdles it has historically faced, is why would we finance you when we don't get results? And I think the argument I kept seeing when you look at it is, well, but what happens when we do?
Yeah.
If we find something, it'll be well worth it. But yes, this is a bit of a needle in a haystack kind of project. And so we get that. Yeah. So in a way, you know, ufology and SETI, they share a very similar fate to one another. And they do sort of play at a game in which a lot of what they have to do is to, in fact, try to make a case funders, to people who have some money.
Yeah.
And also to make their case to the public directly, right? That's where they really have to make their case.
They keep saying, well, we're this close. We're this close.
Yeah.
We have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where are you calling from?
Hey, guys. It's Christopher from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the show. You have a question for our guest?
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. A subject that I find confounding often is cattle mutilation. And I know a lot of people talk about UFOs. People who aren't really interested in UFOs will sort of think about or talk about ET and that kind of stuff in a vague way. But I almost hear no one outside of the hardcore sort of paranormal or ufology knowing about this cattle mutilation thing, which is so weird. It's almost hard to think about. It's hard to talk about. It's so macabre. But, you know, it just seems like something very odd is happening. And I'm just curious what your guest if you have anything to say about that or any thoughts on that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Wow. That's neat. I mean, what's interesting about that is the stories of cattle mutilation, or actual you also get stories of cattle abductions, right? Actually precede the whole sort of flying saucer phenomenon that emerges in the 1940s. There's a very, very famous incident that a lot of people have written about and talked about, of a big airship scare in the late 1890s, right? And what we know is some of the stories that were told about these strange airships that supposedly were appearing all across the United States is that there were several cases in which supposedly witnesses saw their cattle, or at least one cow, being sort of taken up by like ropes or something by this airship. And that becomes sort of part of that kind of lore that surrounds that particular scare. But what we also know from people who study folklore, particularly of peasant communities, rural communities, is that this kind of idea that cattle are being attacked, mutilated, kidnapped, stolen, and things like this by not just your average rustlers, right, but by something mysterious, or by perhaps an animal or a beast of some kind, is something that goes back very, very early in history. And I've heard folklorists talk about it, saying that what it has a lot to do with is that these are stories that are supposed to be kind of warnings to people who, of course, live typically, particularly the small peasant farmer, dating, say, if you think about the Middle Ages or something, are living basically like hand to mouth. And so the idea that cattle could be destroyed or harmed or killed or mutilated in some way becomes part of a story about how precarious, how insecure life on these farms were, particularly back in those days, right? And so what I find kind of interesting about it, therefore, is that the stories about cattle's being endangered, right, and that possibly being endangered by things that are not entirely human, are in fact stories that date back hundreds and hundreds of years, actually.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Thanks.
Yeah, because you want to think of, that's fine, yep, no problem. Thanks for taking my call.
No, go ahead, continue. You were starting to say something.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to make a last note here, but we often think of ET and we want to project onto them that they must be highly sophisticated, of course, from traveling and that sort of thing. So then when you think, well, why would they care about a cow or a dog? Don't they already know everything there is to know about cows and dogs or whatever cattle might have been taken? So it really sort of, it does drive a wedge intellectually. It's for me when I try to think about why would this sophisticated being why would they keep searching through that? But I guess we have to imagine that there's a lot of different species that we're being visited by, and they have different interests and so on. So, but yeah, fascinating stuff. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
One of the things I was thinking about, you've written about the history of the mutual mistrust between ufologists, scientists, and government agencies. Can you tell where you think this mistrust comes from?
Yeah, I mean, it's there, right? We know it's there. Mm-hmm. we know it played out in sometimes rather serious ways, right? Because we know historically from a very early phase already in 1949 and 1950, right? Someone like Donald Kehoe, who ends up, of course, being most well known for not just his books, but for being the director of NICAP, the big national organization in the 50s and 60s. Already back then, he's saying that there's a lot of mistrust on the part of government officials, military officials, of people like himself. And we also know that the government actually did spy on UFO researchers and organizations in the 1950s and 1960s. So there's been a lot of mutual mistrust all around in these issues. And I think a lot of it has to do with, in a sense, a misunderstanding of the motivations of a lot of the people involved. I think that on the part of, you know, scientists who are in the academic realm, I think they have historically viewed the subject not just simply as kind of frivolous and maybe even downright for many of them silly, but I think they viewed the people who did UFO research and who are interested in this subject as people who are anti-science, people who are attacking science and have no patience for it and want to basically embrace what people like the debunker in the 50s, Donald Menzel, called superstition. And I think the reality is when you look at the history of UFO research and the people who have been mostly interested in this subject, for the most part, these are, excuse me, these are people who actually are really, really interested in science, who are deeply, I think, quite well informed about science. They're not anti-science at all. Very few people I've met are anti-science who are interested. I think it's just the opposite. And by the same measure, I think a lot of UFO enthusiasts and people who are UFO researchers have tended to view the kind of skepticism of scientists and people, you know, in my kind of line of work, as people who dismiss these kinds of claims that people make because they view witnesses and they view claimants as dumb or stupid or hoaxers or things. And I think that actually is quite wrong. I think that in fact, a lot of people, particularly by the 1960s and 70s, who are in the academic field, who look at this kind of stuff, actually believe that most people are being actually quite sincere, and that witnesses are oftentimes seeing something, that people are having experiences that are bewildering or outright scary. But that what they do is they believe there might be all sorts of other explanations that can help inform that, right? So I think, in a sense, the mutual mistrust comes from the fact that, for lack of a better term, what often happens is people are talking past one another, that it's actually an inability to communicate effectively that is in large part results in this kind of distrust that everybody has for the other side, if you want to put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So as far as someone had put a question up just before we came back from the break, and what your thoughts were on, like, ancient times, you know, so to speak, ancient aliens. But, you know, I mean, I have thoughts on that myself. I just think we're in as far as a human, you know, existence is just a small sliver of time, you know, for instance. So we haven't really talked much about the actual alien topic itself, but so do you want to just discuss what your thoughts about, like, if we were being visited, were we being visited in ancient times as well?
Yeah. Well, a former colleague of mine actually did some research on this, a guy by the name of Garrett Fagan, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but an ancient Roman historian, and had done some stuff on this. And you know, his argument and about this was that when you look at this stuff, is that it doesn't add up, is that his argument and a lot of his collaborators in this project that he worked on say that by and large, a lot of the kinds of arguments to be made about this involve incorrect uses of evidence, ignoring other kinds of evidence that's out there, so that it becomes at best a kind of a speculative kind of argument about things. I'm not an archaeologist, so I'm never going to claim to know about how archaeology sort of can sort of inform us about this stuff. I think to me, what is intriguing is the notion of invoking aliens to understand certain artifacts. Right, the creation of the pyramids, for instance, or other kinds of things that we consider remarkable or unusual, right? That date back to ancient times. It is part of an argument that is hides a kind of a working assumption in it, and that working assumption is always, of course, that the aliens would come and visit us have to be remarkably advanced, right? The only way they could ever get here and to do the kinds of things that we still find impossible to do as human beings, right? We still are trying to figure out, can we really get to Mars, right, and make that work? Well, these beings would have to be so advanced that they would then, of course, be responsible for, in fact, these great innovations in human history. And I think what some people would argue is what that means is, therefore, it seems to be an undervaluing of human beings. Aren't we a little more wily? Aren't we a little craftier than that? Some people would argue. Don't we show the ability to, in fact, these things, innovate, develop advanced technologies in ways without the assistance of these beings from another planet? And so you kind of get this interesting argument, I think, that's sort of underneath all this, that's really about this question about what are human beings really capable of, right? How good are we at advancing ourselves technologically and scientifically at any given period of time? That's kind of what I find kind of intriguing in those discussions.
Right. Wow. Yeah. You know, as far as the topic of one thing we haven't really discussed much of, and that is, you know, and I'm always the first to say that a UFO doesn't necessarily mean that it's alien. You know, I mean, I'm talking about the, you know, UFOs that are unexplainable. No one, as far as I know, really knows for sure. But you seem to have enough of an open mind to think that it's a possibility as far as us being visited. Alejandro mentioned earlier on that I had a debate a long time ago with Seth Shostak from SETI.
Yeah.
And basically the thought is, you know, the thinking in human terms, they can't get here from there, you know. And I remember asking him something, well, maybe they figured something out in physics that we have not even touched upon yet or something like that. And he actually said, well, it's possible, but unlikely. And so what are your thoughts of, you know, the thing always comes up is the distance thing. What are your thoughts about that if we actually are being visited by a distant intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting that you talk about what Seth Shostak told you. That refrain is a refrain I've seen also in kind of in the archival materials that I've looked at surrounding the crowd who worked on SETI, sort of that original crowd and the people who were working in the 70s and 80s on it. A year ago, for instance, I was looking through Carl Sagan's papers in Washington, D.C., and some of his personal letters and things like that. And one of the things that I saw in there that struck me as kind of reflected my own sort of take on things was some correspondence he was having with one of his involved in SETI. And so this is not them talking in public. And they were both saying to one another, basically, look, I don't see any kind of reason at this stage with the evidence we have that allows me to sort of say in any with any kind of certainty that this is happening or that this has happened. But if one day it happens, it won't surprise me. If we find the evidence or if one day it happens, it wouldn't surprise me. And that's kind of the attitude that they had about it, right? I think we sometimes remember people like Carl Sagan and as the great debunker. I don't know if that's your impression, but you know, he was kind of a little more open-minded about these things than he's often given credit. I don't know. What's your take?
Well, a couple things on that. There is a paper that he wrote in the 60s where he actually was saying there's a probability. I don't know if you've ever stumbled across that.
I don't remember that one, no.
Yeah, but also there is a story now. I don't know how solid this story is, but he was on stage with, I don't want to say it was Stan Friedman, but someone that was around for a long time. And they had a quiet conversation, supposedly, and he basically said, well, I think a lot more about it than I ever talk about it. In other words, he said, and you'll never catch me talking about it. You know, so he's afraid it was a career killer, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I've looked at some of this material, particularly in the 60s when he was just really fresh. He was a greenhorn at that stage of his career in the late 60s. And I've seen his interactions with some of the older colleagues who were physicists and astronomers. And a lot of them were very upset with the way in which he was willing to engage in discussions with UFO researchers. And I still remember one letter he had in exchange with one Harvard astronomer who basically said, I'm paraphrasing now, Carl, stop doing this. It's going to kill your career. You're never going to get a good, serious job if you keep doing this. You're looking ridiculous. And his response was, I believe in dialogue. I believe in conversation. And it's one of the things I really respect about Sagan was he was always interested in the idea that we don't shut down conversation, we open up conversation. I think that kind of reflects my own sort of ethos.
Yeah. If I had some time, I could jump on the computer and try to find that article. I think I posted a link to it on my website at one time. But it was surprising. And it's too bad that it is actually a career killer for a lot of people. And one of the questions I had a scientist on one time, and I said, I asked him point blank, why do you think it is so hard on someone's career and no one can get funding for it? And he said, kind of like what you addressed about SETI, he said, people want results. And if there can't be an end game where there's a result, they're not going to put up some money for it, which is surprising that SETI actually, keeps getting funded, private funding actually, for most of it right now.
Yeah, right. Right. No, I mean, it is something along the. Now, again, what's kind of intriguing is you look at my research and you have to say, well, this is interesting. I've had a lot of the more senior UFO researchers out there say to me, I had one who will remain nameless who said to me, Greg, does the Smithsonian know exactly what your research is about?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I said, yeah, oh, yeah. I said, yeah, I've got NASA funding for this stuff. I mean, and I think the reason why is because I don't think this stuff any longer has the same kind of stigma it had attached to it back in, again, I think the 70s and 80s, when it was, I think a lot of this stuff was viewed as you know, the enemy, as I say, as a kind of the enemy of of good science. But I think the other part of it is, I am a historian. I do approach this stuff historically. I'm not in the business of, as I say, telling people what to think about whether things have alien origins or sources to them or not. I'm not in the business also of spending my time debunking claims. My job and my role is something different, right? In a sense, it's far more modest than any of those things are, in that I'm just trying to capture and recover how it is that people have gone about understanding and making sense of this over time. As I tell people, I research the researchers. That's kind of what I do. I'm interested in that kind of question. And so I think in that sense, it's seen as quite legitimate to ask questions about what, as I have argued in my research, is really one of the most impressive global movements of the late 20th century, and that one that's been basically neglected by so many people in my field, right? That to me is kind of intriguing. And I think that's what I think is the reason why now a lot of these institutions don't see this as problematic, as a problematic field to sort of get into and to look at.
I did have in my notes, I did want to ask you, how did you go about getting funding from the Smithsonian and NASA?
Yeah, well, I started going into these, you know, once I got into this project and I started to make the determination that I wanted to pursue this as a book, I knew I was going to need funding to do this. This is a huge project. How else am I going to get overseas to Sweden and work with those fabulous people over at the Archives for the Unexplained and to Italy and places like that? It was going to take a lot of time. It was going to take a lot of effort for me to get and to do the traveling I needed to do. So I knew I was going to need funding. And then it was for me a question of now, where do I go for those kinds of funds? Who are the likely places to do that? And for that, it's going to be the kind of institutions that fund history of science, the kind of stuff that I've done over the years. But so the first place I actually turned to was to go look at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, who really offered me my first grant possibilities, because there I wanted to work with their collections. And there's where they have Edward Condon's papers. They have Phil Kloss, the great debunker, Phil Kloss's papers, Donald Menzel, another of the great sort of debunkers of the 1950s and 60s. And from there, that afforded me the possibility to say to then other funders, well, look, I'm very serious about this stuff. I've started to publish the results of my research, but to really finish this, I need other possibilities. And so that's when I got involved and applied for some funds through the American Historical Association and this NASA grant. And then I had the great opportunity to be to serve as the Charles A. Lindbergh Chair in Aerospace History over at the National Air and Space Museum last fall, at the Smithsonian. And so there, because I had gotten to know some of the great aerospace historians that are there, I mean, is there another place in the world that has so many of these fabulous people who do aerospace history? So because I made those connections and showed people the way in which I want to approach this subject and think about it, all along the way, I've had nothing but people encourage me, give me support, open up their time to me and give me, you know, let me sit there and not just talk their ears off, but also get advice from them about how to go about doing some of the things I'm doing. It's just been absolutely remarkable. So I have felt like, from my standpoint, doors have opened. I get open doors from people, and people share their time and their wisdom with me all along the way. And that's from all sides, frankly, from everybody I've encountered. I've rarely had a door shut in my face.
Do you think that you have a pretty good advantage because of your status as a professor of history
to open these doors? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I have told people that I don't know that I would have undertaken this project, say, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago in my career. I think I might have been nervous about, would people take me seriously? Would they wonder about what I'm up to or something like that? But in that period of time, I've taken on so many other projects that have taken me in completely other different avenues, as you well know. And the thing is about it, two things. One is that in doing so, I've picked up all sorts of skills, right, and research skills, and an ability to look at an archive in a way that I didn't have 25 years ago. So part of it is where people know that I know how to go about and do rigorous empirical research, right? Historical research. But the other part of it is having earned a reputation from my colleagues and from people who work in the history of science and medicine, who know me and know the kind of ways I go about doing things and how I do it in a really serious, sober fashion. I think it's in that sense, one's reputation, not just having the name professor of history, you know, as part of your title, but having that background, that experience, having proven myself, you know, over many years, that I think is what really matters to people. And so in that sense, that has both served me well, both in terms of opening doors, but also in terms of helping me take advantage when people open the door. I know what to do once those doors have been opened.
Right. Well, being in the digital age, you know, you talked about earlier how, you know, there's the paper trail basically of UFO researchers. Now everything's digital. Do you think that's going to change the landscape as far as research in the future?
Yeah, I think so. I think no question about it. The accessibility to so many records, to so many things, means that just about anybody can take this stuff on and wrap their heads around it pretty quickly. Now, it also means, however, that what the digital age has also done is, as we all are, I think, painfully aware, right, is that it's created a kind of a flood of information and data. Like, where do you begin? I'm sure you've experienced this whenever you wanted to go in maybe and look at something. You said to yourself, oh, my God, like, where do I begin? And also, where and when do I stop? Because it's so much.
Yeah,
so
where's the truth and where's the untruth? And, and when it comes to places like YouTube, you know, what percentage of the, you know, videos can you actually consider that are could be something?
Yeah, and it is a big problem because I think there is reason to question. You know, this to me is also very much a part of my professional and even personal, but certainly my professional code or ethos. Right? Is you always have to be skeptical about your sources of information. It doesn't mean you inherently don't believe it. But what you have to always be asking yourself is, where does this come from? Who designed it? For what purposes? Why is it there? How did it get there? Right? Those are the questions. I would do this if I was studying a completely other kind of subject matter. These are the things that you have to do as anybody doing serious historical research, is always be questioning the material and triangulating, right? Constantly seeing, do I get confirmation of this information from other places that will allow me to say with relative certainty, this document is trustworthy, or this document has some problems, right? That kind of stuff is necessary. And you're right. The internet doesn't always make that easier. It actually oftentimes makes it more complex, more difficult to do, right? Because there's so much of this information, and a lot of times it can be kind of mutually contradictory, right?
Yeah. I muddied the water, so to speak. So as far as the history of do you consider that pop culture plays a part in you know, people paying attention to? I mean, I saw the great article you had written, the blog on comic book covers. Do you think that played a part in what people thought they were seeing or any part of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to say that pop culture and the media has always had a pronounced influence on what's going on and what people are seeing, what people are talking about, and these kinds of things. It goes back to some extent what we were talking about earlier, the fact that if you look at the history of ufology, that by and large, the way in which UFO researchers have tried to get their message across and to reach people and to get people to take them seriously has been publicizing this stuff and getting people's public attention. But we also know when you do the research, you find out that dating back already to the 1950s, what most UFO researchers did back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s into the 1980s to get their information that they would then utilize to analyze material, right, and to analyze data was to, in fact, track news stories, to track newspapers. They all had news clippings files. So it's directly having an impact that in that way on UFO researchers. But we certainly know that certain images, right, certain kinds of ideas that we have in our minds about aliens, for instance, comes to and is derived from these sort of popular images we have out there. So if you were to ask people to describe what they thought aliens and what people reported aliens looked like, say, in the 1950s when the contactees were telling stories, they were very, very different kinds of descriptions than the things you're going to get when you ask people in the 1990s what they look like. And a lot of that has to do with the ways in which popular culture sort of portrayed aliens, whether that was in movies or whether that was in the popular press or the tabloid press. And that has an impact. And so I think you can track that as part of the way in which the general public as a whole sort of think about and try to understand these kinds of things.
Now, as far as historically, the identification of what people are seeing, I want to talk a little bit about that because there are cases that do go way back about triangles. Again, Dave Marler is a person who is going to be talking about that coming up soon in a show. But so triangles, though, were very rare, but there were a few sightings. And then there was the disc, the cigar shape, all that. I think it's pretty amazing now. It seems like there's more triangle sightings than anything else. And, you know, how could, you know, again, talking about, you know, these aren't new models that are coming out, obviously, you know, or something like that. Did you ever look into any aspects of the shapes of what people are seeing?
Yeah, I have actually. I mean, so one of the things that's kind of intriguing is there too, you see in kind of the stories that circulate, right? And that's what a lot of the stuff I focus on, because when we go to earlier periods, we often don't even have direct witness testimony. We have stories that circulate in the media. But if you take a look at, for instance, some of the earliest in the 19th century, some of the earliest stories about strange, as they would call them back in the day, strange airships, right, that people have witnessed. It's really interesting how this stuff tends to track and follow whatever the technologies of the time were. Mm-hmm. So, excuse me. So, for instance, one of the earliest cases that was brought to my attention by a colleague of mine was a story from the 1830s that took place in, I want to say, Ohio or Indiana, among a group of Mormons who had seen, who claimed that they had seen, or maybe it was later. In any event, what they claimed to have seen was a strange airship with all sorts of family members, dead family members on it. But the way this airship was described was it looked like a steamboat, right? because the steam engine was the thing that people saw in those days, and that was what you witnessed. So airships are described as looking like steamboats, right, in running around on the skies. Fast forward many decades later, you get around the turn of the century, around right before World War One, when there are several kinds of scares that go on, particularly in Britain. What do people say that they see? They say they see zeppelins, and they describe dirigible-like kinds of things that are going around. And so the same thing that's kind of interesting when you talk about the ghost rocket scare in Sweden in 1946.
Right.
It's not just rockets that are seen, as you probably know. Other things are also seen. But rockets is the rockets and missiles are the things that are most described.
Landing in the lakes. That's what's
landing in the lakes. Yeah. It's fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm. But again, not a surprise given that there are a number of very, very well publicized famous incidents during World War II in which V-1 and V-2 rockets fell on Sweden.
Looks like his Skype went out. And hang on, everyone. Let me try to get him back on the show. The phone line is open if someone would like to call in. And I'm going to try him on his phone and see if I can get through that way.
Hello.
There you are.
Hi.
So we'll go the rest of the show on the phone here. I'm not sure what happened to Skype. So we were talking about airships and things like that, basically.
So those shapes. Yeah. So it is intriguing to me to see how these shapes can very often link up and connect with, you know, the technologies of the time, right? The things that are getting the most attention. They often sort of had that kind of role that they played when you look at it, sort of the long history of it.
I do understand that, and that is really bizarre, and that kind of makes you wonder that if part of what people are seeing is imagination, you know what I mean? Where else could you go with something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly that's going to be the argument of people who are really skeptical about claims and witnesses who claim to have seen, you know, ghost rockets or flying saucers or things like that. But you know, the counter argument that you read in the UFO literature, going back again from the early times of it, was that, well, but maybe this isn't so surprising because people will describe things and talk about things in the terms that are available to them at any given point in time, right? You, in fact, are going to see things that look that way, right? So, you know, you have apparitions in the sky, you know, when there's a something like an eclipse, for instance, or there's a meteor shower, or there's some sort of atmospheric phenomenon, say, in the Middle Ages, people will describe seeing, you know, a blazing cross in the sky. And people will say that, you know, maybe the explanation for that is not that necessarily people actually saw a cross, but rather what they're describing is a phenomenon that is that seems odd, seems strange and anomalous. They need to make sense of it. And so the best thing that they come up with to describe it is a cross, right? It's the same way, right, with Kenneth Arnold. Everything I've ever seen says he never really described them as flying saucers per se.
Right.
He saw them in a very different kind of shape, but you could tell that he's having trouble describing what he's seeing, right? And so you try to find things to latch onto that'll help make sense of it. I think that is where the you know, history meets up with experience in a way that's often something that somebody themselves who's reporting this stuff is unaware of, right?
Right, right, yeah, yeah. I know they were sort of they had like wings or something, if I remember right, or they sort of,
yeah,
unusually unusual shape, and
bat-like or something.
Yeah, yeah, that describes it pretty well. So and that is very interesting. A lot of people have tried to speculate you know, why all of a sudden all these sightings were happening at the time. And, you know, Stan Friedman, who I brought up a few times on the show so far, you know, his speculation of that is that the, you know, the explosion of nuclear weapons and, you know, going back to World War II and, you know, 1945 and, you know, the tests before that. And does he say? The kids found the matches, you know, and he thinks, you know, because it is strange how all of a sudden, you know, starting in 1947 was a barrage of sightings and right after the other. And then, you know, in 1952 was another major year where there was so many sightings. And so what do you think about that? Why there were so many sightings right starting in 47? What have you thought about that?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, the thing with it, to some extent with what Sam Friedman's saying. So what you, again, when you look at sort of the evidence of like the material, what people were talking about and people were trying to make sense of and to think about this, it's really, really kind of intriguing. And you see this going on, not just in the United States. I've written about this kind of, as I talked about, I think earlier, about this experience in places like Germany, and I've seen some stuff about England as well. What's going on when you look in 1946 with the ghost rocket scare, and then 47 and those first few years, is a really interesting thing. Is that people are truly, truly mystified as to what's going on, and I don't just mean the general public. You can see intelligence agencies are mystified as to what's going on. Everybody's sort of looking at one another saying, what is this? What's going on? And so you see for a while, for several years, kind of all sorts of theories are being put out there to explain it, with some people saying, you know what, this has got to be the Soviets. It's got to be the Soviets. They got to be experimenting with weapons they captured from the Nazis. And then other people saying, No, it's not the Soviets. They're not doing it. It's got to be the Americans. It's got to be the Americans playing with some of their new toys that they have, and but they don't want to admit it. And then you see other people saying, no, this is just people in a panic, right? They're all during World War II. There were all sorts of air raid panics that went on, right? Even while people were, in fact, being bombed, you could still have moments where just a rumor would strike panic in a city, right, about the potential for that. So that what this is nothing more than a kind of mass hysteria, and everybody's seeing missiles and flying saucers when nothing's there. So all sorts of things are floating around. But what's interesting is that when you finally get the argument made by Donald Kehoe, I mean, he's kind of the key figure in 1949 and 1950 about this. Kehoe is the one who really makes this argument. He says the evidence shows that that those people in government who believe that these are aliens, are in fact convinced that what's set this in motion and the reason they're visiting us now with such frequency is because of these nuclear explosions, right? As Friedman says, right? It's that they've seen that we have atomic technology now, and particularly atomic weapons now, so that they are now sort of conducting a kind of reconnaissance, trying to get a better sense about who we are and what we're capable of, and whether contact is possible. This becomes another theory that's thrown around. So you really do kind of have a whole bunch of people all sort of coming up with theories. They oftentimes mutually contradict one another, but all of the theories keep coming back to the same theme about war, about particularly the Cold War, and particularly about the potential for a sort of nuclear holocaust. And that's sort of the constant theme that you see running through it. So I think a lot of the big sightings oftentimes come around the time when there are particular sort of changes in the Cold War, right? Particular moments of a lot of heat, if you will.
Right, and I'm sure you've looked into also the the connection between nuclear weapons and the, you know, the disarming of them and all these different things during sightings, which is another fascinating aspect of it.
Yeah, I think one of the you asked before about pop culture, and you know, one of the other things I've wondered about, I don't know what your thoughts are about this. I mean, there's, you know, a very common argument is that, you know, when movies like
Close Encounters,
Close Encounters, and E.T. came out, you had this sort of big uptick of sightings. But I've read elsewhere from other sources that say that didn't happen. That in fact it didn't spark any great, big uptick. And is that the case? Is that your?
I think you're right, because that was put out there, but it was really just bunk. I mean, there was nothing to back it up. As far as the sightings are, like MUFON does record the amount of sightings and all that, it has for many years, and there was no real spike in that. Now there may have been, there are such cases when, like Hangar One came out, all of a sudden the sightings were really high, but a lot of the sightings reported were from historical sightings. In other words, not ephemeral to the times. The people would say, well, you know, they're watching this on TV. I never heard of MUFON. Now I'm going to talk about my sighting 10 years ago. And so there tons of reports came in like that. So it does have an effect on at least people, you know, paying more attention. So
I think so. I mean, we know that about the X-Files, right? The X-Files mm-hmm. had a definite impression on people. And I think the other thing is, we know with the X-Files, I think what the X-Files did that a lot of movies weren't able to do, because it was on for so long, it could follow different kinds of plots. It really introduced people to a lot of those kinds of theories that existed back in those days, right? Back in the 90s, that a lot of people were not aware of, right? Who had never been exposed to, you know, these kinds of these sort of very, very dark, right? The dark sort of dark theories that I don't think got much exposure until really the X-Files sort of brought those to front and center, right? And to people's attention.
Right, right. We're going to leave the number up there for just a minute. We only have 4 minutes left of the show or so.
Yeah.
So we will take one quick call if someone would like to call in. Otherwise, we're not going to take any calls for the rest of the show, the rest of the four whopping minutes. what about you? We started to talk about, are you doing a documentary?
Yeah, so I've been working on this with a friend and a colleague of mine. He's a documentary filmmaker here at Penn State by the name of Richie Sherman. A few years ago, you know, I was talking with him about this project, and he's like, you know, I'm fascinated with this stuff, and I've always been very interested in it. And as we sort of hung out and talked more about it, we sort of started to explore this idea. Well, what if we sort of take this kind of topic and theme and think about doing a documentary on it. And so that's what we did. And in fact, our first sort of filming we did was at that Congress in 2016 in Phoenix. And we just showed up. I think the only person I had talked to in advance was probably Ryan Sprague.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there were a few other people, and but we just showed up. And as I said, another example where people just open up and are so generous with their time. You know, I showed up. I just started introducing myself to folks. Asked Alejandro if it was okay if we did some filming. He said absolutely, and then just sort of started talking to people like Stan Friedman and Kathleen Martin and people like that, and Ryan. And interviewed folks and just so our approach to this is, it's kind of open ended. We'll be really honest with people. We are still very much in the sort of what does this all add up to phase of things. I've been mostly interested in talking to people about their lives and UFOs, and particularly people, you know, like Stan Friedman, who've got a lot of experience, have a long track record of involving themselves in this stuff. So kind of asking about how they got involved in these things, what led them to it? How have things changed over the course of their lives? What are they thinking now? What do they think the future looks like? These kinds of questions to sort of get a sense of. So in a sense, it's what I guess we'd call oral history. My friend Richie, the filmmaker, I leave all that stuff up to him. He's the expert on that. He keeps saying, I want more action. We need more action. he wants to see people running around and doing more things.
Things landing.
The historian of me, like, yeah, he wants to see something. I said, Rich, we can go on a field investigation, but all of the people I talk to who do field investigations will tell you, right, 99% of them are pretty, you know, undramatic, right?
That's true.
They don't tend to involve a lot of, you know, damn it, let's get in the car and get over there right now, pronto, right?
Yeah.
It's unfortunately, there's not a lot of great X-File moments, right?
That's
it's
right.
It's more kind of painstaking research.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're out of time, basically. If you could just tell someone how they could find you and your website, UFOpastright.com.
Yeah. I have a website which I post sometimes sporadically, more when I have some more time and the semester isn't rough, but UFOpast.com. You could also check out my site, my page on the Penn State Department of History. You'll see there, just look me up, Greg Agigian. And I'm always interested in hearing anything historical. So if people have information or had experiences, for instance, with some of the more well-known figures in the history of UFO research, and particularly those folks who are now long gone and we can't speak with them anymore. I'm always interested in hearing stories.
All right. We're out of time. I'm sorry. Thanks so much. It was a real pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mark.
Okay, everyone. So thanks for tuning in. And we'll be back next week. We're going to be in studio in Exeter, New Hampshire. And thanks, everyone. I really appreciate it. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.